Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll make our first stop in Haliburton County, Ontario, where intimate partner violence is considered to be an epidemic.
A big portion of the reason for the intimate partner declarations across the board is to bring awareness to abuse, to gender-based violence against women.
To Montreal, Quebec, as a record rent increase could soon become reality. This as Quebec's tenancy board permits record rent hikes. Tenants prepare for the worst.
And that's what we're encouraging tenants to do, is to come together with their neighbors and to refuse that rent increase collectively.
Out east in Nova Scotia, he left Burma in 1967 and retired four times. Dr. Mohan Virik, now 89 years old, lives in Cape Breton. He'll soon receive the King Charles III Coronation Medal.
They were going to give me $50 a month pay and food and clothing. I said, oh, that's good. It never occurred to me that I have another choice. I work from 7 till midnight. Every night I worked.
And a 200-foot-long Indigenous mural is revealed at the RBC Convention Center in Winnipeg in hope of inspiring dialogue and reflection.
I think art can be very important in that way, to just open up the dialogue, visually educate people.
This and a little bit more on Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
We're on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for being with us this week. Quebec's Tenancy Board, the TAL, has set recommended rent increases at an historic high this year. Landlords following these recommendations can raise rents by up to 5.9%. The TAL recommends increases based on consumer price indexes and landlords' expenses, including management costs, maintenance, and building services. These high increases have led several tenant support groups to launch campaigns promoting education and tenants' rights. HOJO, the Off-Campus Housing and Job Resource Center, is a resource from Concordia University's student union. They are now running a series of workshops on how to refuse rent increases and negotiate with landlords. Here's Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
HOJO has begun a series of rent increase clinics to help students understand their rights to refuse rent increases and negotiate with landlords. Here's HOJO's assistant director, Adia Giddings.
The tribunal announced 5.9% rent increases. That's the highest that it's basically ever been. And we will see definitely some extremely high rent increases this year.
The clinics will run on February 17th, March 12th, March 26th, and April 10th. They will cover information from how to recognize illegal rent increases to the skills needed to negotiate with landlords.
Most of the time, your landlord will send you a notice that will say you have the right to refuse and move out, or you have the right to accept and stay. But there's a third option, is to refuse and stay. A lot of times people don't know about this right. So a lot of our office programming is built around this fact of just informing people of their right to refuse.
Off campus and around Montreal, SLAM, the Montreal Autonomous Tenants Union, is also raising awareness about rent increases. SLAM keeps membership in their union anonymous to protect members from dealing with harassment during ongoing conflicts with problem landlords. CJLO spoke to two of their members about why they're encouraging tenants to join them.
There's a bunch of reasons why someone might come and be interested in joining a tenants union. Like, the truth is that all of us as tenants have skin in the game and have a reason to be motivated to join a union. All of us as tenants are paying rent. All of us as tenants are living in a situation where our housing is in the control of a landlord and can be taken away. So that being said, big reasons, big motivators for joining the union include evictions, rent increases or being priced out of your home, landlords who are not doing repairs in the building or poor living conditions, and other people join the union out of a sense of solidarity and wanting to work together to challenge this housing system and to build alternatives together.
SLAM is an advocacy group hoping to prevent large increases like this from being recommended again and encourage what they call solidarity among the tenant class.
SLAM's approach to refusing a rent increase really focuses on collective action. And this means the first thing that you should do if you're getting a rent increase is knock on your neighbor's door, because it's almost guaranteed that they're receiving that same increase. And so when you're coming together, you're breaking down the isolation that tenants feel and that landlords are relying on. So if you're knocking on your neighbor's door and sharing your experiences of this 5.9% increase, or maybe you've got an 8% increase or a 10% increase, it gives you the opportunity to refuse together. And that's what we're encouraging tenants to do, is to come together with their neighbors and the other people who are living in other buildings that their landlords own, and to refuse that rent increase collectively. A landlord has one tenant who's refusing the rent increase. That landlord might have motivation to take that tenant to the towel. But if that landlord has 10 tenants who are refusing, or 20 tenants who are refusing, you're creating a lot stronger of a barrier to that landlord being able to take all of these tenants to the towel. And that means that you have a stronger chance of successfully having that rent increase refused.
The towel recommends increases based on consumer price indexes and a number of expenses, including management costs, maintenance, and building services. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Adam, who also reports on an unusual statistic, an independent research group in Montreal found out that 40.8% of federal MPs are landlords. There is a growing list online of MPs and MLAs across Canada who are landlords and who invest in property. The project is led by Montreal journalist Isaac Peltz, and independent researchers from across the country are now giving him a hand to compile it. Peltz believes sitting politicians renting property could be in a conflict of interest. Check out this story on frequencynews.ca.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
So if you're a woman living in a rural part of Northern Ontario, you are 75% more likely to experience domestic abuse. That's what a delegation from the YWCA told members of Haliburton County Council recently. Intimate partner violence, which includes physical, mental, sexual, and financial abuse, is impacting an estimated 2,500 women in the county, according to Statistics Canada. That's why the delegation asked Haliburton Council to join a growing number of municipalities across Ontario in declaring it an epidemic. The request for the declaration came out of three feminicides, gender-based murders against women, which occurred on the same day 9 years ago. Haliburton County joined 95 other Ontario municipalities in declaring intimate partner violence an epidemic. More with Elizabeth Hoakley.
It's a staggering reality. In Haliburton County, with the challenges of rural living that include social isolation, transportation challenges, and other barriers, an estimated 2,500 women here are experiencing domestic abuse. That figure, based on StatsCan data for population density and gender demographics, is why Haliburton County Council recently declared intimate partner violence an epidemic. Nicole Duncan, manager of both the YWCA Women's Center in Minden and the Haliburton Emergency Rural Safe Space, or HERS, says while it's an issue that may seem hidden in rural communities, the truth is women continue to endure abuse in many forms here in Haliburton County, including physical, emotional, sexual, and financial.
The reality is that rural realities, especially northern rural realities, are put women at a greater risk. So intimate partner violence is an epidemic. I can't say why we're still here. You know, I wish I could. We continue to show up every day for women and their children.
Haliburton County councillors heard from the delegation, which included Nicole Duncan, Kim Dolan, Executive Director of the YWCA Peterborough Haliburton, and Brittany McMillan, Executive Director of the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center, and learned that the request to declare intimate partner violence an epidemic here stems from a coroner's inquest into the 2015 murders of three Renfrew women by the same man who had a relationship with each of them in the past. The tragedy exposed failures in the systems meant to protect victims of intimate partner violence. Gender-based violence toward women, which includes femicide, is on the rise, and reports from the Ontario Provincial Police confirm the rates of domestic violence for women in rural communities are 75% higher than for women in urban areas. Nicole says the fact that Haliburton County supported the declaration is a step in the right direction. So far, 95 municipalities have joined in declaring intimate partner violence an epidemic.
In Haliburton County fashion, I can say with you know, some pride that they heard what we said, they listened, and they didn't deliberate. They made that declaration in real time during the delegation. And I think a big portion of the reason for the intimate partner declarations across the board is to bring awareness to abuse, to gender-based violence against women.
Nicole says the YWCA Women's Center in Minden is a judgment-free safe space where women and their children are supported. No matter where you are in your journey, there's help, encouragement, and practical assistance whenever you're ready to reach out.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
A.K. Breton's doctor is receiving the King Charles III Coronation Medal, recognizing outstanding commitment to community and country. Dr. Mohan Virik relocated to Cape Breton from Myanmar, Burma, in 1967, devoting most of his time since then treating people from the Ekasone First Nation. He's now 89 years old. He retired four times since 2020 and returned again last month on a part-time basis because of doctor shortages. Virik says he's humbled to receive the medal, but he says credit goes to his wife, Mabel Ann, who supports his career and understands the many hours away from home. Bill McCush in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, spoke to Dr. Virik about his passion for medicine.
An 89-year-old Cape Breton doctor is receiving the King Charles III Coronation Medal, recognizing his many years as a physician in Cape Breton. Dr. Mohan Virik tells CKOA Radio he relocated to Cape Breton from Myanmar, then Burma, in 1967, devoting most of his time since then treating the people of Eskazoni First Nation. Virik's dream of relocating here happened when he was in grade 5, when a political science type assignment had him write a letter to the Canadian embassy, and he developed a passion to move halfway around the world, and that passion continued after studying medicine in his home region.
Over there, the education was such that you could, after graduation, work in States, Canada, USA, UK, anywhere, because we wrote many exams from those countries at the same time. So I wanted to come to Canada, and I didn't know where to go. I started writing a letter from Newfoundland, and I was going back. I finally got a letter saying that you could come and work here. They were going to give me $50 a month pay and food and clothing. I said, oh, that's good. So I didn't come with a big job or anything like that.
Virik soon became attached to the people of Eskazoni, and most of his patients throughout the years are from the First Nation. He felt a connection to the community, and he says they needed someone to watch out for them.
If you look at the early medical care for the native people, it was very compelling that you stay with them. You know, the last 50 years, 60 years I was with them, it never occurred to me that I have another choice. I worked from 7 till midnight. Every night I worked. And in the hospital, they had groups. You know, doctors would take one day or 2 days a week for call. But nobody will take me as a partner because they said, oh, native people come in all the time. They bug you. They're drinking. Things like that, the cliches that. So I was on call every night. And it was a very compelling reason to stay with them. That's how I stayed there. Very satisfying experience to work with them.
Virik delivered thousands of babies whose parents are from Eskazoni, and their closeness rose above a typical doctor-patient relationship.
You know, they just took me in as a family member. Some of them called me Papa. Somebody named the kid after you know. So you become a family member with them. We had a sign in Escasoni, no patient after 2 o'clock, but we were open till 10 or 11 at night time. But it was just kind of a love affair with the people there.
Vera continued treating the people of Escasoni, and the bond developed throughout the decades. Then one day, about 5 years ago, he tried to hang up the stethoscope, but it didn't last.
It's kind of funny. It's a very profitable thing to retire and come back, because when you say you're retiring, they give you some presents like a meal, a ticket for Boston Pizza or something like that. And then I finish up all those, and then I go back to work and start again. Tried to retire 4 times. And each time, I retired actually in 2000. I said, that's, you know, I must retire. But then the patients call you and they come home. And in the end, you say, oh, better for me to go to work.
Of the 4 times Varick retired, recently he returned to medicine again, because he says he is still in good shape and his absence left a void in local healthcare.
So now I retired again. I think in January I retired. But I still, God has given me health, and I love what I'm doing. So now I go to primary care. I work 2 days there. And then whatever I can do from the phone, I do that. That's how my schedule is.
But it's not just patients who are reaching out to Dr. Varick. The government recently sent an email to him notifying him that his nearly 70 years of treating patients with a focus on First Nations is being recognized with the King Charles III Coronation Medal. He says he overlooked the message in his inbox, not realizing the significance.
You know, I got this email on 10 days ago, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't open it. So just a few days ago, I opened it, and I thought I looked very arrogant that I didn't reply back. So I did that yesterday. But it's just more than that is the love that you get from your patients, right? I'm a doctor who's just doing what I'm supposed to do. You know, I'm not doing anything.
Meanwhile, Varick says there would be no medal without the support of his wife, Mabel Ann Varick. He says she supported his dedication to medicine so much that even their wedding day was marked with him going to work.
Actually, if any accomplishment is, she sacrificed, because I was never home. I left at 7 and I came at 11 every day. She raised the kids and she never complained. The day of the marriage, I was on call that night. And I was a little shy telling my people that I'm going to get married, and I thought they'll tease me. So I was on call and I took the call. So I took 3 hours off and got married and came back to work. And then that night, I think I went at 9 o'clock to St. Rita's. We went to honeymoon to Bedeck. So I came to the hospital. There was a child had a crib death. So I came there and I stayed there till about 3 o'clock. In the morning when I went back to the hotel where we were staying, I see a lot of cars in that motel. And I said, wonder why there are so many cars. So since I wasn't there, she called her friends and they were having a pizza party. I robbed her from, you know, all those things. But she never complained. He was a rock on my life, you know. Which she just accepted there that she let me do all the silly things I did. 67 years, I think, we are married. And she's the rock of my life.
How they met? Well, she helped him with a delicate procedure at the Glace Bay Hospital when they were both young healthcare professionals.
So we were going to do a circumcision. And in med school, they teach you all the big things, but they forget simple things like how to remove a toenail and how to do a circumcision. So I had never done that. So she was in, she worked in the obstetric department. So I asked her, I said, you know, I've never done circumcision, but you stay with me. She said, yeah. So we did the circumcision at that time together. And I think things just sparked from there. But a year and a half later, we were married, and We have married since 67 years now.
Ferrick says his roots are here on the island of Cape Breton, and this is where he says he wants to stay. One day while flying high above Canada back to the island from out west, he made a wish and got a divine reply.
Coming one day from Winnipeg after a meeting, and the plane started shaking up and down, and everyone started praising. So I looked at the window and I said, Jesus, God, the only thing I have asked you that I die in Cape Breton, and this is not Cape Breton. So I thought you had accepted that promise that I can die in Cape Breton. So that's the love for this country.
Dr. Ferrick will receive the Coronation Medal sometime in the spring. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
A new 200-foot-long Indigenous mural is revealed at the RBC Convention Center in Winnipeg in hope of inspiring dialogue and reflection. The mural was painted by Indigenous artist Justine Brou. The mural entitled Returning to Our Roots tells a story of Indigenous culture, nature, and renewal. Brou says she wanted to explore how the loss of community and culture has caused many Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to become lost. Murals weren't how Poo got her artistic start. She started as a tattoo artist, only transitioning to murals after tattoo shops had to close during the pandemic. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Indigenous artist Justine Brou believes art is healing, and the 200-foot mural they created outside Winnipeg's RBC Convention Center could be a catalyst for conversation and community.
I think art can be very important in that way, to just open up the dialogue, visually educate people and teach people in a way that is easier, I think, and more natural to come across, as opposed to writing a public announcement or forcing people to read a book or something, you know, like it just gets the interest going a little more, and then we can move into that education portion.
The mural titled Returning to Our Roots tells a story of Indigenous culture, nature, and renewal. Prue wanted to explore how the loss of community and culture has caused many, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to become lost. The mural embodies themes of balance and connection to the earth, featuring the four seasons, sacred medicines, eagles, and bison. Prue says it serves as a reminder of the importance of reconnecting with nature and each other.
I really wanted it to kind of be, as you walk down the street, like a journey through the season. So the first panel starts at spring, and it starts with an eagle, and the eagle's very large. He's like holding the land. And, you know, eagles in the seven teachings represent love. They're also the bird that's closest to creator, the animal that's closest to creator. So they're very like highly regarded in terms of like a spiritual animal. So that kind of starts off our mural. And there's like the colors are a little bit more muted in the spring panel. You know, you can tell that life hasn't fully come back from winter yet.
The second panel of summer features vibrant colors, cedar, a muskrat, and a snapping turtle, representing the creation story. On the fall panel, the colors darken, showcasing three bison, sage, and the cycle of the moon. Winter includes sweetgrass, a moon, polar bears, and the northern lights, with more muted tones. Symmetry is another important element of Prue's art.
When you're looking at the mural, if you can look at it straight on, the sun and the moon are mirrored. Symmetry is something I put in a lot of my murals. If you look at most of my artwork, it's almost perfectly mirrored, or half night, half day. And I really enjoy getting balance through in that kind of visual way.
Murals weren't how Prue got their artistic start. They started as a tattoo artist, only transitioning to murals after tattoo shops had to close during the pandemic. With an empty classroom, Prue's mother, who teaches Indigenous studies, asked if they could come and paint. Seeing a post of that mural on Instagram, a teacher at the Louis Riel Arts and Technology Center, where Prue had taken classes, reached out to commission a mural at their school. This quickly turned into a full-time passion.
Now it's almost, I mostly do that full-time. Like, I'm pretty much always painting some type of mural. Yeah. So the wait list of the murals got kind of long. I think at one point I had like over 15 schools on it. I think I have eight or 10 now that I'm still needing to work through.
Returning to our roots is Prue's most recent work. The four-piece mural between Carlton and Edmonton Street includes didactic panels on the pillars separating each image. These describe the symbolism and significance of each visual element. Prue notes they will add a QR code once the winter weather improves that describes the image and their meaning in even greater detail. Through all their mediums, Prue says they hope to spark conversations, inspire others to embrace creativity, and foster deeper connections between people, culture, and nature. I'm Ryan Funk.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
We now pause to take a breath of fresh air and turn to the skies as the annual Prince George Christmas bird count held between December 14th and January 5th came back with big numbers. This year's count smashed previous records, running like clockwork since 1968 and held this year on January 5th. Never has the event seen this many birds. A total of 19,641 birds were counted, smashing the previous year's number of some 6,500 birds. However, 11,000 of those identified were Bohemian waxwings. Here's part of Ian Gregg's conversation with Kathy Antoniadzi of the Prince George Naturalist Club in British Columbia.
This year we found lots of birds, but the weather was good. We had very good effort. We had a lot of people out looking, and so there's lots of food, and there were good numbers of redpolls. Some of it's encouraging. Three woodpecker species set all-time high counts, so that's encouraging. Flicker numbers, the northern flickers, the woodpecker that's common here in town, numbers are up, and they've been trending up. There were lots of owls around. There have been lots of owls around the airport. So we found five species of owls, I think. Oh, we had lots of robins. That was interesting. Just because we found lots of birds doesn't mean that the actual numbers of birds are up. They were up here for this winter on that day.
We'll take any good news we can these days, Kathy. Thanks to Ian Gregg for that excerpt. And that's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists Ryan Funk, Elizabeth Oakley, Bill McCouche, Adam Innes, and Ian Gregg. To our national editors Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox, Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. It was great to have you with us this week again. And until the next, ciao.
Tuned into Viewpoints.